All right, this brings up our final case for this morning, which is case number 102028, United States versus Griffin.
May it please the court. Jadrian Griffin was convicted with evidence obtained as a direct result of the police's decision to pull him over based on nothing more than an anonymous tip from an unaccountable tipster. Dispatch had told police that there had been a road rage incident and to be on the lookout for a black man driving a blue Yukon. But the police didn't know anything about the person who had made the report. They didn't know the person's name. Their telephone number.
Well, they knew the rough location as well, didn't they? And he was spotted in that vicinity.
That's correct.
Or
but as
in the opposite direction of where they thought it would be. But
in the general vicinity, that's correct. But as the Supreme Court said in JL, an anonymous tip or a tip must be reliable in its assertion of illegality, not just in its tendency to identify a determinate person. They could have said the same thing in JL. There really was a black man in a plaid shirt standing at the bus stop, but the Supreme Court ruled that that was insufficient cause to stop him and check to see whether he had the firearm that he was accused of. All they knew was that this person called in on a cell phone, and under JL, that is insufficient to justify a traffic stop. And I would remind the court that the government has never argued that they had reasonable suspicion to pull him over. They've assumed that they didn't have reasonable suspicion, but argued that they acquired it later. So the rule is that evidence is inadmissible when it's jettisoned as a result of an unlawful seizure. And a seizure occurs when there's a show of authority and submission to that show of authority, and we have both here. We had a show of authority in the lights and the sirens, and we had voluntary submission to that show of authority. There's no dispute that Jadrian Griffin voluntarily pulled his car over to the side, voluntarily exited his vehicle, and voluntarily allowed himself to be arrested without incident. So the only issue in this case is when did the seizure begin? And this court has indicated in Bradley that a seizure can be a process, a kind of continuum that begins with the means that produces the submission. In that case, it was physical force, a bullet to the back of the car. And this was true even though there was a gap in time between the point at which the bullet entered the car and the point at which the suspect stopped. As the Fourth Circuit said in Wilson, a case that's cited in our briefs, physical movement alone does not negate the possibility that a seizure may nevertheless have occurred. So the logical extension of Bradley is in cases where seizure is affected by a show of authority. The seizure must begin with the show of authority itself because that's the means that produces the submission in those sorts of cases.
Actually, Bradley's a use of force case and not a show of authority case. This is really a pure show of authority case, and he didn't stop until after he had gotten rid of the drugs and ignored the show of authority for a considerable distance.
That's true, and Hodari D is a physical force case as well. But in cases where a show of authority,
Hodari D is a chase like this one, right?
It is.
It's not a force case. It's a chase case. This is a chase case. It's just a slow speed chase.
Well, Bradley was a chase case as well.
Right, but the import of the court's holding in that case is once the bullets were fired, the seizure was effectuated.
Correct, because the physical force produced the submission. And what I'm saying is there are two kinds of cases. There are cases where there are seizures affected by physical force, like Bradley and Hodari D. Hodari D was tackled. That was the physical force that produced his submission. Then there are cases like this one, where there's a show of authority that produces submission. As the Supreme Court said in Brower, the suspect's independent decision to continue the chase does not eliminate the police's responsibility for terminating his freedom of movement. And this makes sense because under Terry, courts cannot isolate from constitutional scrutiny the initial stages of the contact between the police and the citizen. A seizure has to be justified at its inception. You cannot separate the submission from the means that produces the submission. And this is true whether it's a case like Bradley, where physical force produced submission, or a case like this, where a show of authority produced submission.
So when the red light and sirens go on, is everyone who sees and hears it seized?
No. Mr. Griffin was seized because he voluntarily responded to that show of authority. I'm not aware of anyone else responding to that show of authority. That's why he was seized.
So the rule you want is if someone hears that siren and stops, they're seized, whether they're the target of that or not.
Well, clearly they were directing the show of authority at him. They were following him. They had turned on their lights and sirens, and he eventually submitted in direct response to those lights and sirens.
Right, but the point of Fodari D is that the seizure doesn't occur until the submission, which...
Then Bradley doesn't make any sense because, again, there was a gap in time between the point at which the bullet entered the car and the point at which the person physically stopped. So
if the police had called this off part of the way through, but he'd already tossed the drugs, they could go ahead and grab those and they could link it to him and charge him with that.
Well, his decision, his independent decision to toss the drugs has nothing to do with whether there was a seizure. A seizure occurs, again, when there's a show of authority and voluntary submission to that show of authority. The drugs, what I'm trying to say is that the drugs would have been rendered inadmissible, whether they had been found on his person, whether they had been found in his car, or whether they had been found along the path of the pursuit, because they were jettisoned as a direct result of the police's initiation of an unlawful seizure. Now, his decision, his 60-second decision to resist law enforcement, certainly justified the police's decision to arrest him for resisting law enforcement and for whatever crimes he committed along the path of the pursuit. But it did not retroactively justify their decision to initiate an unlawful seizure. Exclusion of the evidence in this case makes sense. It creates the right incentives. First of all, it deters police from pulling people over based on less than reasonable suspicion. As Terry says, limitations on evidence to be gathered from a seizure tend to limit the quest for the evidence itself. Exclusion of the evidence also encourages, or at least it doesn't discourage, suspects from stopping, because suspects are still subject to prosecution for whatever crimes they commit along the path of the pursuit. In contrast, the government's result, allowing use of this evidence, legitimizes the police's decision to initiate an unlawful seizure. As Terry says, use of evidence in a criminal trial tends to legitimize the conduct that produced that evidence. And the government should not be allowed to profit from evidence it gained solely as a result of its decision to initiate an unlawful seizure. And so we would ask the court to reverse the judgment and remand on that point. One quick note, if I may, on the crime of violence issue. The issue, as you know, is whether a conviction under Indiana law for ordinary flight by vehicle is considered a crime of violence for sentencing purposes. This very issue is currently pending in the Supreme Court, was argued on January 12th in a case called Sykes, and will almost certainly be decided this term. Both sides agree that it would be appropriate for the court to withhold its decision on this issue until the Supreme Court can rule, and I would simply again ask you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Onjanek.
May it please the court, my name is Matthias Onjanek. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. The district court correctly denied Griffin's motion to suppress evidence because Griffin was not seized when he discarded the crack cocaine. On February 3, 2007, officers McDonald and Butler were on patrol in Evansville, Indiana, where they heard over the police dispatch, a be on the lookout for a black male driving a blue Yukon that had been involved in a road rage incident. At that time, they do locate in that vicinity Jadrian Driffin driving a blue Yukon. They decide to follow the car and then turn on their lights. When they do turn on their lights, emergency lights initially, the defendant, Jadrian Griffin, slows his car down, pulls to the curb, but then makes a decision at that point to flee, to continue driving and to disregard the officer's show of authority. At one point, they turn on their loud sirens. At one point, there's two police cars following Jadrian Griffin. At one point, the police get on the loudspeaker and command him to stop, but Jadrian Griffin does not stop. In fact, he commits the felony offense of fleeing from law enforcement and commits the traffic violation of disregarding a stop sign, almost causing a collision.
That traffic violation occurred before the drugs were tossed, is that right?
Yes, sir. After all that, he then at one point drives into the parking lot of a local attorney there, Robert John and Associates, and police are following him. Everything, sirens going. He still does not stop. Shortly after he exits the Robert John and Associates parking lot, he does pull over. But there's a government's exhibit, trial exhibit 2, and then government's motion to suppress exhibit 1, which shows the route of Jadrian Griffin. And in looking at that, there's no conceivable way to go that route but for to try to elude police long enough to discard the evidence, whether he was looking for a dark area or looking for a certain distance from the officers. There's just no conceivable way to do that route. The government believes the issue is exactly like the issue in California v. Hodari, in that the issue is when the defendant discarded the evidence, was he seized at that moment? And, of course, we need two things for a seizure, a show of authority, which no doubt took place, but we also need that second component, which is the defendant submitting to police authority. And at the time Jadrian Griffin discarded that evidence, he had not submitted to police authority. In addition, at the time he discarded the evidence, the police did have reasonable suspicion. In fact, they had probable cause at that time to pull him over because he had fled from law enforcement and he had committed that traffic violation. So in those two issues, I know defense counsel spoke about it being a process, but when Jadrian Griffin discarded the evidence, he was in the process of fleeing law enforcement. He was not in the process of submitting to police authority at that time. And again, I think that the court pointed out that Bradley was a gunshot case, a use of force case. It did not have the same issue as we have here, which is at the time of flight, at the time evidence was discarded, was that person seized for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
I'm a little surprised you didn't argue that there was reasonable suspicion at the time they turned their lights on initially, given the cases we have involving 911 calls about domestic disturbances and firearms and things of that nature. You've got a report of a road rage incident on a roadway of some sort. Why wasn't that a reasonable suspicion?
Your Honor, a couple things. I thought the 911 call was somewhat unique in that it was an anonymous tip. Typically in these situations, the person will stay on the line and provide their name. They didn't in this regard. Also, after I got this case, I asked other patrol officers in our area what their typical response is to a be on the lookout. And the typical response of a police officer there, at least the ones I spoke with, is not to immediately turn on your siren. It's to observe what's going on, possibly look for contextual reasons if there's traffic violations, but to more size up the situation. So I was not comfortable arguing that to the district court or to this court, especially in light of the fact that Jadrian Griffin never stopped.
So you concede there was no reasonable suspicion at the time the lights were initially turned on?
Yes, sir. I just don't feel comfortable in this unique situation. That says I don't consider the actions of the police officers unconscionable. I mean, they just, I think, reacted a little bit too soon that night, or were maybe a little bit too excited about seeing the actual Yukon and black male driver and then turned on their lights. But again, I don't believe that matters here, because at the time of the Jadrian Griffin discards that evidence, he was not seized for Fourth Amendment purposes. I concur with defense counsel about the second issue. regarding the crime of violence that is before the United States Supreme Court. And then in the last issue, I will stand on our brief in that regard, but point out there is Seventh Circuit precedent that the Fair Sentencing Act does not retroactively apply. If there are no other questions from the court, then I'd yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Paul, you've got a minute and a half.
Very quickly, Your Honors. We have a concession from the government that they did not have reasonable suspicion to pull Mr. Griffin over. And the only reason they obtained this evidence is because they decided to flip on their lights based on an anonymous tip from an unaccountable tipster.
Well, we did have the intervening traffic violation in the flee.
And, of course, that justified his citation for that traffic violation, and his decision to flee justified his arrest for resisting law enforcement. But it did not and it could not retroactively justify the police's decision to turn on their lights based on nothing more than an anonymous tip. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Paul, you were appointed to represent your client in this case. You do have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and the court. And the case is taken under